I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news now for 30 years in two languages all over the world. Here in the United States, interviewed four presidents, worked at four major U.S. Television networks. And I believe that news should be honest and direct and impactful. And this is Direct Impact. The U.S. decision to deploy cluster bombs in Ukraine seems to be putting a spotlight not just on the insidious weaponry, but you know what else it's doing? It's putting an emphasis on our foreign policy doublespeak. Cluster bombs are banned by 123 countries and condemned categorically by human rights groups worldwide. Here's what makes their usage so roundly shunned, by the way. It's essentially a missile, right? But it contains thousands of little bombs. And those little bombs, or bomblets as they're actually called, spread out over a large area. But see, that's not the end of it. The real problem is, as the U.S. originally discovered in Southeast Asia, 30% of the bomblets, they don't explode when they hit the ground like they're supposed to. That means they can just sit there for a year or more. Years sometimes, until later when a person, often a child, who comes in contact with it is killed or maimed. Children are particularly susceptible to this. You know why? Because these little bomblets, they look like toys. It looks like a little toy. So they come up and they pick them up and not knowing it's a bomb, it just blows up on them. Children. In fact, because so many civilians have been killed by cluster bomblets, many now call the use of the weapon a war crime. A war crime. In fact, here's President Biden's own former press secretary, Jen Psaki. This is in February of last year, suggesting that very thing.
There are reports of illegal cluster bombs and vacuum bombs being used by the Russians. If that's true, what is the next step of this administration? And is there a red line for how much violence will be tolerated against civilians in this manner that's illegal and potentially a war crime?
It would be. I don't have any confirmation of that. We have seen the reports. If that were true, it would potentially be a war crime. Obviously, there are a range of international fora that would assess that. So certainly we would look to that to be a part of that conversation.
That video, by the way, of Jen Psaki, it's gone viral. I mean, globally viral. Viewers all over the world citing it as an example of really hard to deny, right? Overwhelming hypocrisy. Because here now is her former boss explaining why he is sending these cluster bombs to Ukraine.
What made you change your mind and decide to give them these weapons?
Two things, Fareed, and it was a very difficult decision on my part. And by the way, I discussed this with our allies, discussed this with our friends up on the Hill. And we're in a situation where Ukraine continues to be brutally attacked across the board by munitions, by these cluster munitions that have dud rates that are very, very low, I mean, very high, that are dangerous to civilians, number one. Number two, the Ukrainians are running out of ammunition. The ammunition that they call them 155 millimeter weapons. This is a war relating to munitions. And they're running out of that ammunition, and we're low on it.
Look, with all due respect to our president, let's not be fooled by the, yeah, but, you know, golly gee explanation. This is really a special circumstance this time. In fact, let's be clear. When it comes to U.S. foreign policy, cluster bombs are really the norm, not the exception, the norm. According to the Cluster Munitions Coalition, the U.S. has by far used cluster bombs more than any other country in the world. We have used cluster bombs munitions with devastating consequences in conflicts all over the world. Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, 60s, 70s. We used it in Iraq and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, 1991. In the former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Montenegro, Kosovo, 1999. Used it in Afghanistan, 2001 and 2002. In Iraq, 2003. And most recently in Yemen, 2009. The U.S. also supplied cluster munitions to Israel, which they used in combat against Lebanon and Syria. In fact, we've produced and transferred hundreds of thousands of cluster munitions to at least 30 countries. And look, I'll name them for you. It's Argentina and Australia and Bahrain and Belgium and Canada and Egypt and Denmark and France and Germany and Greece and Honduras and Italy and Japan and Jordan and South Korea, and Morocco, and the Netherlands, and Norway, and Oman, and Pakistan, and Poland, and Saudi Arabia, and Spain, and Thailand, and Turkey, and the UAE, and the UK. Not to mention Indonesia. Now, beyond the haphazardness of the comments suggesting that we don't mind, what, killing innocent civilians, even if perhaps they're children, as long as we can punish Russia? There is another reason why many Americans are against the use of cluster munitions. You see, it's not just the opposition that often gets killed by cluster bombs. It's our own troops. Look at what happened repeatedly in Iraq. American pilots scattered thousands of cluster bomblets indiscriminately. And in so doing, they placed unmarked, indiscriminate, and long-lasting minefields in the path of their own ground forces. While it wasn't reported at the time, at least at the time that it happened, we now know of at least 18 incidents where unexploded cluster munitions occurred during Desert Storm, killing, maiming scores of U.S. troops and Marines. Here is how Russian President Putin is responding. He says it's a sign that Ukraine is going through stockpiles of shells supplied by the West at an exceeding rate, which is why they're needing these cluster bombs, he suggests. He also warns, somewhat ominously, that Russia has the same weapons.
Хочу отметить, что в Российской Федерации достаточный запас различного рода кассетных боеприпасов. Различного рода. Мы до сих пор этого не делали, не применяли. И у нас не было такой необходимости, несмотря на известную нехватку в определенный период времени, и у нас тоже боеприпасов, но мы этого не делали. Но, конечно, если они будут применяться против нас, мы оставляем за собой право на зеркальные действия.
And joining us now to talk about this is Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. And you can check him out, by the way. He's very popular on YouTube with his channel, The Real Politic with Mark Sloboda. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Rick, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the show.
One of the things that I find interesting about our president's comment, about respectfully, President Biden's comment, is that there seems to be a suggestion that the situation in Ukraine is already so terrible, and both sides apparently have been using massive weaponry against each other, that what difference would it make if we were to add some more weapons and throw them into the mix as well? It seems to be what he's saying. I've never quite heard a president or a world leader say something like that. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with it. Are you?
Well, I think it's a clear sign of desperation, more than anything else. All military experts, you name them, agree that this has become a war of attrition, not just between Russia and the U.S.-backed Kiev-Putsch regime in Ukraine, but between Russia and NATO, de facto. Mm-hmm. A war of attrition fought largely through artillery, right? Western papers have reported that at times 70 to 90% of Ukrainian military casualties have been a result of artillery shrapnel or explosives. Now, here's the problem. Russia has the Kiev regime outgunned with artillery shells, according to their own top general, Valery Zaluzhny, 10 to 1. That is despite NATO throwing every spare artillery piece, howitzer, and artillery shell they could into the conflict. Several European states have stripped their own militaries, including the United Kingdom and Denmark, Estonia, you know, of every single artillery piece and shells. An endless amount of shells are needed. The Kiev regime was firing between 5,000 and 6,000 artillery shells a day. And Russia was firing between 50 and 60,000 artillery shells a day. And that's before the height of the current dual offensives on both sides of the conflict.
So if we are at that point, war of attrition, key word, how would cluster bombs change that equation? Can you explain? I think I know where you're going with this, but I'd like to hear you put it in your words and for our viewers who are watching you right now.
Yeah, it wouldn't. Both certainly the Kiev regime has already used cluster munitions in this conflict. In fact, Human Rights Watch and even the New York Times reported on this back in 2014 when the Kiev regime almost immediately after seizing power in Kiev in 2014 started raining cluster munitions down on their own civilians.
Okay, but let me stop you for a minute, because I really want to get at this question. I get it. Ukraine has used them, at least according to reports I've seen. In fact, this type of weaponry has been used in this conflagration, this conflict before. But that's not my question. I want to know, as a citizen of the United States of America, why my president, my government, has made a decision that by doing this, it can alter the war, maybe win the war for the side that they're on, that it can somehow be a real differentiator. How?
That's not the reason they're doing it. They're doing it out of desperation because they don't have any artillery shells left. These cluster munitions are in 155-millimeter artillery shell jackets. They want to fire something, even if it's not the best munition for the particular battlefield use. Sometimes they are, sometimes they are not. They're not very good on the offensive. As you noted in your beginning intro, that if you're firing and creating an Aratz minefield in front of your troops in a trench and then sending your own troops on an offensive into that trench, you're sending your own troops into your own self-created minefield, right? That's not smart use of cluster munitions. But they're using them because NATO, the U.S., even U.S. allies, Israel, South Korea, and Japan have already run through all of their artillery stockpiles of 155-millimeter shells. Their industrial complex can't ramp up to meet the demand because they haven't been geared up for this type of land-centric, artillery-heavy conflict for decades. So they're throwing something, they're tapping cluster munitions in artillery shells.
So it sounds like, by your definition, desperation means that short of this usage of these cluster munitions, they would have nothing else left. Of course, save, you know, the most dangerous weapons in the world, that would be the nuclear weapons that obviously we have no plans to use, right?
That is the key point here, I think. I think you've hit it right, the hammer or the nail right on the head. Where do we escalate from here? The Kiev regime starts using ever-increasing amounts of cluster munitions. Mm-hmm. Russia is already reported to have started using them. They have much bigger supplies of cluster munitions that they have largely refrained from using thus far in the conflict, right, with greater varieties. Where does the U.S. escalate next to? Well, okay, so we're already talking F-16s, ATACMS long-range missiles, chemical weapons. The U.S. has large supplies of chemical weapons. Tactical nukes? Stealth bombers? What's next? What is after cluster munitions? Where do we escalate from here? The intensity of the conflict right now is the most intense that it has been in a year and a half of the conflict, right? It's ever increasing. It's ever increasing intensity, more armaments, more troops. And the results for NATO's, you know, proxy forces have not been any great progress at all on this great, much ballyhooed offensive.
So
what did they do them next?
Let me look at it. Let me flip the question and look at it another way. From you're in Moscow right now. You read the papers in Moscow. You see what the sense is there with the people and the government. Is there a sense then that if NATO is running out of weaponry, to a certain extent, I'm sure, and the United States is as well, and the other allies are as well, and obviously Ukraine is, because they got nothing if they ain't got help from NATO and the United States, then doesn't that create an enormous opportunity for Russia to just go ahead and go in and perhaps do what they originally wanted to do in this theater?
Which is why Russia is already beginning a large offensive right now, largely unreported in the Western media, in the Lugansk region towards Kupansk and Liman. According to the Kiev regime, some 100,000 troops, 900 tanks, 2,000 pieces of artillery, and multiple launch rocket systems. And they're already making more progress than the Kiev regime has in the last 7 weeks of their offensive. There is no incentive now for Russia to go to the negotiating table. NATO keeps escalating, but they're running out of things to escalate with. How do you fight an artillery war without artillery shells? Cluster munitions, okay, they can be used sometimes, but they're not always the best tool for the job. Russia is seeing NATO tapped out, and they are not prepared to back down. In fact, their initial war goals have only toughened since the conflict has begun.
What do you expect that the reaction is going to be in the next weeks, maybe the next month, from President Zelensky regarding this that we're talking about right now? Is he privy to the fact that his supposed ammunition in this war is being depleted on a regular basis, and that soon he may not have any place to turn?
Of course he is. I mean, I think you can hear that in the ever increasing shrillness of, you know, his rhetoric, of his demands, of his, you know, shilling for ever more weapons, ever more money. I think he is desperately aware. I think it's got to be causing really emotional problems for him at this point. His propaganda bubble has built up so much that he can't dare puncture it and admit that kind of reality to his own people, his own troops.
Okay, stay right there, okay? I think this is a fascinating conversation, and we're going to continue it in just a moment. I'd like to continue this conversation with you. What do you think of this? I'd love for you to reach out to me on Twitter. My handle is RickSanchezTV, RickSanchezTV, and I'll be looking for you right there, and we can have a conversation. When we come back, though, there is a strange partnership developing in Congress, and we're going to tell you who the bedfellows are. You stay right there.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions?
Going underground can.
I started in 1983, fishing with my father on a gillnet site. I feel exactly the same as a kid does when he goes out in the lake in a canoe and he's fishing for a panfish with a rod and reel.
My family's been halibut fishing for a really long time. My mom was pregnant with me, still longlining, and I grew up on longline boats.
I've been halibut fishing since probably 1978. It was my first year that I seriously went into it.
The exploitable biomass is near historic low levels. Growth rates have dropped.
Bottom trawling, when it's done in its worst form, has a leveling effect and has a tendency to really just sort of strip away everything that's there.
The way fisheries are changing, it's the way our country is changing. It's increasingly hard for small businesses to make it.
Abundant stocks are important. I mean, who wants to fish the last fish?
The message I would leave to you is the importance of not giving up. the importance of working together and also the importance of taking care of your corner of the ocean.
And welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. Look, it's not huge, but we're starting to see some pushback at President Biden, even from his own party on this issue. Here is Congresswoman Barbara Lee coming down hard on Biden and the use of cluster bombs.
Cluster bombs should never be used. That's crossing a line. Once you see what takes place, we know what takes place in terms of cluster bombs being very dangerous to civilians. They don't always immediately explode. Children can step on them. That's a line we should not cross.
And here now is what's even more interesting. Democrats and Republicans, who normally agree on absolutely nothing these days in the United States, they can't agree on what to have for lunch, are finding some agreement on this topic. Here's Republican now, Congressman Matt Gaetz, saying that he will join the Democrats on this issue of cluster bombs.
I'm going to be the Republican co-sponsor of the Jacobs Amendment before the House Rules Committee. We have an opportunity with bipartisanship to stand against the warmongering Bidens.
And back with us now is geopolitical and military analyst Mark Sloboda. Mark, thanks so much for being with us. What do you think of, let's not make more of it than it is, but you're starting to see some resistance, some pushback in Congress. You saw what Barbara Lee had to say, though she's always felt that way about wars, unnecessary wars, one of the few, unfortunately, in our country who does. But now you have Matt Gaetz, Republican, and there are a few others out there who are saying, look, we shouldn't be doing this. Do you think this could be the beginning of a groundswell?
Rick, I tell you, I think it's nice to see, right, from the left margin of the Democrats, and shall we say from the Trump margin of the Republican field, right? It's nice to see. But unfortunately, there's still a broad bipartisan consensus on both sides that are the middle ground between those two tiny margins that's a lot larger, that are fully in support and, in fact, pushing the Biden administration for more, for F-16s, for ATACMs, you know, for, you know, if they could put cluster munitions inside of ATACMs and launch them from F-16s, they would. So it's nice to see, but I don't think it's I'm just too cynical to expect any type of real pushback to come from inside the belly of the beast.
So lacking that, it seems like the only thing that would make sense in terms of pushback against President Biden and his administration on another war, need I say, this doesn't look to me any different than Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, I mean, Libya, Yemen, I could go on, where enough Americans finally say, is there anything we can do to try and resolve this thing? Is there a way we can bring about some kind of peace deal? Why don't we sit down with both Putin and Zelensky? Why do we only sit down with Zelensky? Is that a crazy question that I should be asking, or other Americans should be asking?
You remember how many Americans protested against the Iraq war?
Quite a bit, and it never got any coverage.
Millions, yeah. Millions. And it had no effect on the conflict.
Because it was only a 30-second VO, a 30-second voiceover on the nightly news when millions of people show up in New York City or in Washington, D.C. protesting a war. If nobody knows it, it's like the tree that falls in the forest, Mark.
And you realize better than anyone what a monolith in support of U.S. foreign policy that the U.S. mainstream media outlets are. So I don't see room for any type of radical change, whether it's from the populace, from the fourth estate of the media, from within, you know, the bowels of the government or the deep state itself. I mean, take a look at how Syria ends, right? Syria hasn't ended in any type of diplomatic resolution. U.S. military still illegally occupies eastern Syria. Turkey occupies the north of it. The Syrian government with Russia has control of the rest of the country. But with the U.S. sitting on the oil and wheat fields, you know, there's no hope of recovery. There's no peace deal. There's no talking to the enemy because you've demonized him and caricatured him to such an extent as part of your foreign policy that it is impossible then to lower yourself to conducting diplomacy with an enemy that you have villainized to a cartoonish degree.
Can we agree? Let's get back to cluster bombs. Can we agree that cluster bombs should be treated, if not like nuclear weapons, damn near close to it?
I'm a military guy, Rick.
children 5 years later picking them up and dying in, you know, the thousands. I read a story recently that said that they are still finding them in Vietnam.
In Laos, the U.S. dropped so many cluster munitions on the country, a plane load of them every 8 minutes for almost a decade, that at the current rate of removal, the government there estimates they'll have completely cleared their territory of U.S. cluster munitions in 800 years.
That's incredible, as much as it is shameful. And as citizens of this planet, we should be responsible for allowing anybody to do that kind of crap, I think.
To be honest, I'm more worried about depleted uranium ammunition. That has genetic effects, causing birth mutations in subsequent generations, as we've seen in Iraq and Serbia. It does immense ecological damage. It is a weapon of mass ecological destruction as well. But depleted uranium ammunition has been supplied to the Kiev regime by the United Kingdom, and the U.S. has been talking about it as well. That has also entered into the conflict.
And here's the problem. Here's the problem, Mark. I remember when I was younger, and so were you, that we saw these great meetings between people like Gorbachev and the premiers of China signing all these deals with guys like Reagan, and they were actually working, not so successfully, but working toward agreements where they said, let's shake hands and say we won't cross that line. We won't do this. We won't do that. We won't use this kind of weapon. It seems like today we're going in the opposite direction. And it doesn't seem to me, and that's not just to blame my country, because I think Russia and China and the U.S., all of the large countries on this planet, have not had the willingness to come together to do this. And they should.
Sure. I think during the Cold War, there was at least rules of the game, right?
Yeah.
That were more or less respected because both sides had a degree of respect and fear of each other. And certainly, I think Russia and China respect and fear the United States. Mm-hmm. But the United States, through this unipolar moment of the 90s, they lost that fear and respect of other countries. They came to believe in U.S. primacy and hegemony everywhere in the world, and they don't think they should have to negotiate with countries that they see as their ideological opponents and their moral inferiors.
You say moral inferiors.
Sure. That's a prime tenet of the U.S. ideology, the supremacist ideology of U.S. exceptionalism. The U.S. believes that it is systemically and morally superior to every other country on Earth. Therefore, it can do no wrong.
Mark Sloboda, it's a delight to be able to talk to you. I know you know and study this stuff on a daily basis, so thank you so much for your insight. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go, I want to remind you of our mission. It's simple, really. I want to try and de-silo the world. We've got to stop living in these little boxes where, you know, one side doesn't understand what the other one may believe or see. Truths don't live in boxes. Truth is everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide direct impact, by golly.